Welcome to Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Alison Swan Parente is a leader and a role model who has had two very separate careers. For more than three decades, she was a child psychotherapist. But at the age of 60, she retired and set up her own bakery. Initially, she struggled to find good bakers, so Alison decided to train her own. A year later, she founded the School of Artisan Food on the picturesque Welbeck Estate in Nottinghamshire. 16 years on, the school has become a raging success, winning industry awards, creating national headlines, and leading a nationwide campaign to promote sustainable food and preserve traditional skills. Her students are taught bread making, cheese making, brewing, butchery, and much, much more. Alison has said, "My greatest pleasure is to see students of all ages, from all walks of life, producing delicious food in a thoughtful way." Alison Swan Parente, it is our great pleasure to welcome you to this episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast.
Well, it's lovely to be here.
So when you opened the Welbeck Bakehouse, I think it was 2007, and then the School of Artisan Food a year or two later, you had no formal background in baking or food. You'd spent decades as a child psychotherapist in the UK and in America. So what made you want to change your career?
Well, I wanted to change my career because my last career had come to a kind of normal end. I had been working with interesting, challenging young people for years and years. I love working with naughty kids. That's my thing. But in the latter part of my career, I had been working with child protection. And I think only about 10 years of those could do in anybody's life. It's a very upsetting area. Right. And so I decided to retire when I could do it, at the age of 60. But it was absolutely clear to me that I really wouldn't survive not doing anything.
So you went down this road of baking, of food. Is that something which had always been a hobby and interest, or was it more than that?
I think it was just part of my life. I think I came from a family that was an ordinary, you know, my dad was a doctor, my mum was a nurse. It was just after the war, so food had been a big issue during the war. There hadn't been much around. So when they both came back from kind of service all over Europe, they had actually come across a lot of very different food when they were in Europe. My mother was a nurse who went into France on D-Day, actually, just after D-Day, and went all the way through Europe down to Germany. And I think she learned a lot of stuff about food then. My father didn't cook at all, but was very interested in food. So I grew up in a family where food was always made from scratch. And I think that it was just part of my life. I didn't think of it as anything extraordinary at all.
And so during your first career, you cooked for yourself, just kept an interest, or had your mother passed her skills and interests on to you?
My mother had passed the skills and interests on to me, along with a great library of completely typical cookbooks of that era. Robert Carrier's Foods of the World. I think Constance Spry's Entertaining Cooking, all of that kind of cooking. But I had kind of rejected that, I think, as a way of living my life. I didn't want to cook like that.
What do you mean by you didn't want to cook in that way?
Well, I still feel that the School of Artisan Food is not a cooking school. We don't teach people how to make dinner party food.
So it's this sustainable food. It's traditional processes.
Yes, it is. It's something to do with going back to fundamentals. And I had seen that probably the biggest influence on my life was living in a communal household in America during the 1970s, where all the men cooked. And I'd never seen that before.
And what was, so how did that come about? Where had they learned their cooking skills?
I don't know where they'd learned it, but they'd learned it for political reasons. They Right. were doing it because it was something that wasn't usually done in households. They were done because the women were fed up with cooking and telling them that they'd got to learn anyway. I think that the real influence on artisan food came from watching and learning about bread making in New Jersey in the 1970s.
So this is where it started. This is where your interest was sparked.
Yeah. It also became clear to me that if I cooked, I wasn't going to turn into a 1950s housewife, right. which was my aim, was not to turn into a 1950s housewife.
So did you ever envisage that learning bread making from fellas in a house in 1970s America would end up as a second career?
It would never have occurred to me in my wildest thoughts.
But it did.
It did.
It sparked an interest. The school, which you run very successfully now, is a charitable trust. And it's part of this campaign to promote sustainable food processes, preserve traditional skills. So, you know, what has motivated you to take this on and move it forward over the last 15, 16 years?
Well, I think my first motivation was to produce good bread in the part of North Nottinghamshire that we were in. The only place I'd seen really good bread in Britain before was in London. Actually, it was being produced in other places, of course. That was my first motivation. But when I started the school, it was really, and still is, to do with providing routes into employment for young people. Because as a child psychotherapist, I had seen lots of, especially teenagers, wondering really how to think about their future, whether they had any aspirations at all. And I think that it occurred to me that learning a skill like bread making for the new bread economy and the new food economy would be very helpful for them. I think that if you're thinking about how to help young people be resilient, one of them is to help them be creative and one of them is to give them a job.
Your part of North Nottinghamshire, traditionally coal mines, a lot of traditional industry which has been in great decline in recent decades, and so part of your issue was to create the jobs that would give young people a better opportunities in that.
Absolutely.
And so it was bringing together two strands of what you do.
Absolutely, yes. It was to do with thinking about, I think I am very interested in what makes young people resilient. Not in, you know, how awful they are and what the causes of their difficulties are. And we all know what the causes of their difficulties are. It's just, why are some young people much more able to withstand the horrible pressures around them and some aren't? And giving them a place to be stronger, I think, is very helpful.
And you've been able to do that while at the same time turning this into a business opportunity. And part of that is you've partnered with Nottingham Trent University, where we are now. We're Nottingham Business School, part of Nottingham Trent University, to deliver degree courses in artisan foods. So why is that important?
Well, when we first started the school, we didn't know what we were doing at all. And we started with three different diplomas, one in bread making, one in cheese making, and one in butchery. But one of the things that we had to do, of course, was to take money, because that had to pay for the teachers
it's
and
a fact
the building.
Of life, yes.
It was a fact of life. But it did look like a kind of private institution very early on. And my very first wish really was to make sure that everybody had access to what we have to offer. And of course, the way to do that is to accredit it properly and then to get access to things like student loans. So the partnership with Nottingham Trent wasn't just really good for us in terms of the extremely good reputation of NTU, the fact that they have a very, very good track record in allowing all kinds of people to learn and to gain qualifications. It was that really it gave us an opportunity for much wider access and inclusion.
Artisan foods are popular and have been in recent years, haven't they? So how do you ensure that your school, your business, continues to prosper as trends change and move on?
Artisan food has always been very popular. It just hasn't been called artisan food. If you've got an allotment and you take veg out of your allotment and you put them into a pie, that's artisan food. You don't have to go anywhere near a shop. You don't have to go anywhere near any marketing. People have always had artisan food. And then along comes the great food revolution where things become much more processed. And we all know about how the kind of impact that that ultra high processing has had. So I think that one of the reasons that artisan food has always been popular is because it tastes very good, and it is probably, you know, because of the lack of processing, it's probably much more healthy. I think now that we realise just how bad ultra-high processed food was. I mean, I remember my father with Smash and Angel Delight, those two.
Angel, we loved Angel Delight.
Exactly, exactly. You put it into a bowl, you put the whisk in, you whisked it round, and there was this delicious kind of completely palatable
stuff. Don't knock it,
stuff.
Alison, don't knock it.
I'm not knocking it. I'm saying how wonderful it was. But sadly, the baby got thrown out with the bathwater.
It really was bad for you, wasn't it? Really bad for you, yes.
We had no idea how bad it was.
And people are now suffering the consequences.
Well, you do see, sadly, you see, when all of this ultra-high processed food comes in, you actually see the graph of obesity going up. There's a very clear correlation between all kinds of processing and ill health and metabolic illness.
So this is more than just a trend. A fad artisan food. Okay, we've got a nice marketing friendly name for it. But this is going to go on back to eating real food.
Yes, and I think that, you know, it's extremely interesting for us to look at all the evidence based research coming out. When we started, we had a kind of intuition that this food, the processes, the fermentation processes, all the changing processes in the food were good for all kinds of reasons. You know, we knew that there was a lot of microbiological work going on as things were fermenting. We knew all of that kind of thing. But what we didn't really realize was how much better it is for you because of the gut microbiome, all of those kinds of things. There's an awful lot of work going on now that just affirms what we've been doing all this time, which we're happy to see, but we're quite surprised too.
So you're quite an evangelist for this now, aren't you?
Oh, I am an evangelist. I'm a terrible evangelist.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded, competitive markets. So, if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA to explore the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. You mentioned marketing then there, so I'm gonna bring it back to marketing, because I've been watching the reruns of your old BBC Top of the Shop program that you did with Tom Courage, and one of the things that you focused on, at least in the couple of episodes that I saw, was the fact that food entrepreneurs, people who are setting up business in food, often forgot about their marketing. So unsurprisingly, I went online and found a large volume of very positive features, news stories, photographs, videos about Welbeck, about the School of Artisan Food. So I'd ask, how hard in business terms did you have to work for that? Because it's great marketing and publicity.
I think marketing is essential for any business. But what kind of marketing is the question? Because I feel myself, and I think it's because I don't know very much about marketing theory, I feel that the only really good marketing is authentic marketing. So, for example, on the estate, we have a very good cheesemaker who makes something called Stichelton cheese. You can't buy Stichelton cheese because it runs out. This person has never done any marketing in his life, in a conscious way, but he talks about the cheese all the time to anyone who'll listen. And he's so interesting that people come from all over the world to interview him about his cheese. But that's because he knows a lot. It's very, very good cheese, and he's a very good talker.
He's authentic.
He's authentic. He hasn't actually got a marketing plan. And in fact, he hasn't got a marketing department. So I think that that's the kind of marketing that I would advocate. And that was the kind of marketing I was thinking about on that program, actually, with people producing really good stuff that they knew all about, that they, and that they just have to get that message out any way that they can. They've
like
got to be evangelists. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. I got that. Well, on the flip side of that, I also read a line as I was doing my research from your son, who runs the farm shop at Welbeck, as I understand it.
Yes.
And he joked something along the lines of that he was relieved when you opened the bakehouse because it would keep you out of his farm shop business. So I'm going to ask you the obvious question. You always enjoy being in charge.
I am a terrible control freak. I realise that. I don't think of myself, of course, I'm very self-idealising like most people, so I don't think of myself as a control freak. But then when I see other people doing things, I am always wading in to do it for them. I'm a terrible micromanager. I have to pull myself away and think very carefully about the fact that there are people who can do most things much better than me.
Okay, is that a leadership tip? Don't become a micromanager.
It is a leadership tip. You've got to know what's going on.
Yeah.
Then you've got to trust the people that you employ.
I also read that you launched the School of Artisan Food as what you called a retirement project. So are you conscious now, well, over the last 16 years, of being a role model for people starting their careers later in life?
I'm not, but then every now and then I come across someone who says, well, you started that when you were 60, so maybe I can start something and do something at that age. So I'm really happy if people follow that kind of lead. I was incredibly privileged. You know, I had a very good career. I had lots of resources. I was incredibly lucky to get the grant that we got from the East Midlands Development Agency to start the school. I was able to do some things at risk, which some people aren't able to do because of resources. So it isn't that you can just suddenly, anyone at 60 can get up and go. But there's a very good, one of the daily newspapers is running a weekly article about changing their life at 60. And every week there's someone extremely interesting who's changed their life at 60 in either small ways or big ways.
So, wait a minute, have you put your name forward? A nice bit of authentic marketing there? I'll look out for that one. I'll look out for it. So, okay, so let's take your second career rather than your first career and give us your proudest leadership moment within that.
I have lots of little proud moments, I think, rather than one big proud moment.
Okay.
I think just walking into a classroom and seeing everybody very absorbed in what they're doing learning something that they might not have been able to learn elsewhere, being able to be with other people and talk with them about things that they have in common. I like people coming back to the school just to drop in and say hello and tell us what they're up to, and they're usually pretty pleased with what they're up to.
I was going to say, and presumably they're doing a multitude of great things.
Yes. I'm proud of the fact that we work with refugees and that we've always got a place, a free place for refugees, and people very, very kindly support that. I'm proud of the staff because they're so good. There are lots of little things that I'm proud of all the time.
Okay. And on the flip side, what do you look at again and think, oh, I wouldn't do that again.
Oh, well. There are some very difficult people to work with. Artisan food is like arts and crafts. There are these people who are incredibly good at what they do, and they've been doing it on their own for a very long time. And they are longing to convey their skills to other people. But they are also perhaps longing for those students to have the same experience that they had, which was pretty bad when they first started.
Yeah.
So, for example, a butcher really feels that a student butcher should be cleaning up a butcher's block and doing nothing else for the first 2 years.
Doesn't work like that now.
Doesn't kind of work like that anymore. And that's quite, you know, that does have some management challenges.
It's interesting you say that. One of these pods has been with Sat Baines, the restaurateur, yeah. And he sat and talked about his career start in a kitchen. And, you know, much of it was illegal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he roared with laughter and has made a point of not putting his students through that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's become a template for him to avoid. Okay, so that's been a challenge, has it?
That has been a challenge.
Okay, so... So you've talked a little bit about your artisan food courses, the courses that you deliver for Nottingham Trent, but this is a podcast for the Nottingham Business School. So based on the success of your career, and I know you're playing it down, but 16 years, lots of big headlines, lots of awards, lots of success, and your campaign to persuade us to think more about the food that we eat, what leadership advice might you offer us here at the Business School?
I have always felt that leadership involves hanging around the shadows of the institution that you're in and just making sure that you are hearing most things that are going on, that you're quite discreet about what you have heard, and that having heard everything, when people come to you to talk to you about their particular challenges, that you're there, that's part of your listening. I think it's listening to people all the time. I'm really doing more listening than giving out. Yeah.
More listening than talking.
Yeah.
That's good advice. Alison Swan-Parente, it has been a great pleasure to have you here with us for an episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders podcast. Thanks very, very much, Alison.
Thank you very much, Mike.
If you enjoyed this NBS Business Leaders podcast with Alison Swan-Parente, why not listen to previous episodes with the two Michelin star chefs, Sat Baines, the CEO of 200 Degrees Coffee, Rob Darby, or the CEO of the Chartered Institute of Management, Anne Franca OBE. This episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders podcast was produced and edited by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.